Hey, everybody. Shop Talk Show number 272. We have a special guest this week, and we're going to talk a whole bunch about color. Color is tough in web design, even just like picking the right ones. But there's a lot more to think about with color and screen design of any kind, really. And that's making sure that you do right by all those eyeballs looking at the thing that you do. And that, I'm talking about accessibility, of course. Like, do these colors have enough contrast? Do these colors work even with people with visual disorders of some kind? We're going to talk about all that. And then let's say you know all that information and there's a decent amount of awareness over that already. How do you take that information and put it part of your workflow? Well, there's a new book all about that. And it's called Color Accessibility Workflows. It's by Jerry Cody. Jerry's our guest. We're going to meet her in just a moment. But for now, Dave, please kick things off.
Shop Talk Show this. I'm Dave Rupert. With me is Chris Goyer.
Who is happily smiling and nodding to Dave's introduction to that. The reason that sort of makes sense is because we have Jerry Cody on. Hey, Jerry.
Hi.
Who is not Japanese, but has been studiously studying Japanese.
Yes, I have. Yes,
it's always a pleasure to have a fellow Japanophone on the podcast. I appreciate it.
Yeah, it's pretty cool to, like, you know, have one of my kind here on the other end of a podcast. Sorry, Chris.
You know, there's only about 130 million of us.
That's so all. That's all.
Yeah.
Oh, that's funny. So it's not exactly a dying language. I was up at the, this was a really cool little mini experience for me this last weekend. I went to the Hamilton Wood Type Museum, which is here in Wisconsin, which is like kind of a world famous place for wood type, and among the fascinating things was a typeface created for what was a dying language, which is kind of sad. It's always sad to learn that, like, oh really, there's four people that speak this thing. Ooh.
Really sad. There's so many around the world. They're just dying out. It's like, I don't know. Japanese definitely isn't. I actually read that it is the highest paying language in the UK this year, which is quite surprising.
Wow, weird. Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of business and stuff like that. Japan does have a decreasing population, though, and it is a bit worrisome.
Yeah, but, for sure.
But anyway, this is not the Japan talk show.
Not necessarily. It's about...
But Chris, why did we bring Jerry in the studio
today? Well, I mean, it could be any number of reasons. Of course, there's lots of things to talk about, but probably the most big, specific, relevant thing at the moment is talking about color, possibly the worst possible thing to talk about on the radio, as nobody will see any color whatsoever other than what's just coming through your eyeballs right now, assuming that you can see color, which is something we'll get into. The book is called Color Accessibility Workflows, available now from A Book Apart, which you might as well buy alongside Practical SVG, I should say. Really good pairing, I heard. But anyway, Jerry, tell us about the book.
Right. So the book is a bit of an expanded version of a book I wrote a few years ago about color accessibility. So this time I've gone much deeper into the topic. And I've talked not only about how to make accessible color choices and how to help, you know, how to actually choose more accessible colors, but how to actually...
That's interesting. Right away, when I think about color, I'm like, well, that's what most designers and developers think when they're like, I have to work with color as part of my job. They just think of just picking color at all as being difficult and cumbersome. Yeah.
But you're going to take, you know, many tips that you learn and you'll see online talking about accessible color, you know, how to make this more accessible to people with color vision deficiencies, but, you know, also people with low vision. So, a lot of people have asked me, how do I then take all those little tips and tricks and turn it into something I can use in my workflow? Like, how do I make it easier to approach my bosses and say, you know, this is something we need to have, not just at the end of a project, but we need to kind of weave it throughout our entire workflow. So my book focuses a lot more on that and how you can take everything you've learned and stitch it together and just basically have no real excuse for not having color accessibility as part of your workflow for forever, for the rest of time.
There's that muscle memory stuff is how I've talked about it in the past, not necessarily with the larger concept of I'm aware of this stuff, I know about this stuff, but how does it get into my workflow? I talk about that in some ways. There's some parallels to my own book about SVG, because there's a level of awareness of something like SVG. Like you're saying, there's awareness that color accessibility is a thing, but maybe it isn't nailing it with how do I make this a part of my day to day?
Exactly. And you know, the more tips and tricks you learn, and there's so many things that you can do. And it's not just color accessibility. I mean, it's, you know, all forms of accessibility. The more you learn, yes, you can say, well, I'm just going to learn that and do it through muscle memory. But you eventually get to the point where you've learned so much, it's going to take more time to do. And at that point, you know, if your boss says, well, we don't have that much time to, you know, why are you taking so long? It's like, you need to be able to think about it right from the beginning, from day one, project kickoff. Here are the things that we are going to implement in this project, and this is how we're going to do it at every step. So it just makes it so much easier at the end, so that you're not scrambling to fix mistakes. Like if you're going to run your website or your app through a contrast checker or a compliance checker, and you come back with all kinds of problems, and you know, you might have time to fix those and you could fix them after launch, but if your site is designed badly from the beginning, there could be some real issues in there that you really wish that you knew about up front and you had time to work in up front, or even before you ever presented a design to the client, for example, because that opens a whole new can of worms. If you show, say, a palette to a client and they love it, and then you go ahead and design with it, and it comes back with some serious color accessibility issues. And they're like, they get really attached to it. And it's like, well, I thought these were going to be our branding colors.
It's at that point, it's your fault.
It's kind of your fault. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So I like to talk about all that. And I think working in advertising as well has kind of helped me.
Just to stick with that for a minute, how would you walk that back if you had, you know, okay, it's your fault, you screwed up, but is there some trickery you could employ there? Could you like have everybody put on glasses that simulate some kind of color blindness and be like, hey, do you still love it now? Look at how problematic this could be.
I think you just have to kind of fess up and educate the client at that point and say, hey, you know, actually, you really need to think about color accessibility, and these colors that we chose are probably not going to be very good. So, you know, there's always compromises that you can do. And if it's a text problem, it's probably not going to be that big of a deal, because chances are your text on a website is going to be black anyway. But for bigger problems, for big branding problems, like if you've got big colored banners with certain branding colored text over it, you know, you don't want to give a client a false impression and then turn around and take it away from them because it was your fault. You didn't know it was going to be accessible. It was not going to be accessible.
The book, again, Color Accessibility Workflows, A Book Apart, which is known for fairly short books to begin with. This is a brief, so it's even shorter than that. In fact, this podcast might be longer than it would take you to read the book, possibly. Yeah, I don't know. We probably shouldn't have you read the thing out loud, but maybe you could walk us through it a bit more. Like, what's the journey that we'll take in this book, you know,
So first I talk about what colorblindness is. So kind of like the science behind it. And I think it takes a certain amount of understanding of the science around how it happens and why it happens to understand why you have to think about other people and how what they see is not going to be necessarily the same as what you see.
So they being, can we do that part? Like I think the easy one is just like colorblindness, but I'm sure there's nuance there too, right? So is most of this about vision, right? So color accessibility is people that have some kind of, well, I mean, what's the best way to say it? Like a malady or?
I would say that the more common term used these days is a color vision deficiency, because when you say the word colorblindness, there are so many people who think that just means that you see in like black and white or shades of gray, which does exist, but it is incredibly rare. And
really?
That's the rarest. It's like it's very rare. And there's also a version of that colorblindness that is actually shades of gray, where it also comes with other vision problems as well. So you might have reduced vision on top of not being able to perceive any color. So it is quite a severe condition, and it is not very very common. So the more common forms of color blindness is actually what you would call a color vision deficiency. So you might just have faulty cones, is what you like you call in your eyes, that are basically absorb wavelengths of light, and it's how you perceive, how your brain perceives color. So if you have just a fault with, say, one of those cones, you may not actually know that you have a color vision deficiency. You may not really be able to tell. And from day to day, you know, you can function fine. You don't really have any problem seeing anything, but it's still there. And that's why there is such a high percentage of the population with some form of color blindness or color vision deficiency.
And what's one of them? Isn't the, like, I have some awareness of this. Isn't it like my reds and greens are real bad? Wouldn't that be just that would be a particular kind of?
Yeah. So there's two different kinds of that. There's deuteranopia and there's another called protanopia. So the most common one is deuteranopia, and that is definitely the most common. And say about 5% or so of males are affected by it. So that's what, it's also called a green weakness. So okay. That would be, you know, not necessarily saying that would be the one that you have. It could also be protanopia, which is also affects the red and greens. But the deuteranopia is definitely the most common.
So what could you really screw up if you were not, if you just had no awareness of this and you just ignored it entirely, even if you did have awareness of it, like a field of red with a green button on it or something, and in your mind you're saying, oh my God, this green really pops, this is perfect, it says buy now, everybody's going to click it, only to find out that to a certain subset of your users, they can barely see this button at all? Is that?
Yeah, exactly. Red and green, if you think about interfaces on websites and apps, I mean, those are the two most common colors for a successful action being completed or one that's failed. So if you don't have any other information on the page and you just do it through color, which I have definitely seen, and I think many people have seen that, they may not notice that they have seen it because if they're not colorblind, they wouldn't know. But if you are colorblind and if you have a red-green form of colorblindness, you are not going to be able to tell those colors apart. You might know, like, if they're next to each other, that they're different, but if it's on its own, you may not know if it's red or green or what it is. So that's why you have to use more information in your design. Like, you have to actually label your buttons. You have to label your actions. Don't say in the copy of your website, you know, click the green button to complete this transaction, or click the green button to, I don't know, yeah, add it to your cart.
It reminds me of don't say click the button on the right or whatever. Too,
yeah, exactly.
Like chances, yeah, it might not be on the right all the time, or they might not see green at all.
Exactly.
That's very interesting.
I have a situation right now. Clients' brand colors are green and red, and they have a green button on a red field, but my project manager, my client point of contact there, he's actually colorblind. He has the red green colorblindness, and he's just like, yeah, I don't see it. I've never seen that button because it's the same color to him, and it's really interesting. So, and it's like, but we're fixing it. We'll fix it. But yeah, it's interesting. It's something you don't think about. So
yeah, especially with things like green and red buttons and interfaces, because I think we're conditioned from, you know, early days in the internet that those are the color messaging, and beyond the internet, like stoplights and any kind of like physical interfaces, like those colors are so common. So it's understandable why people don't understand why this stuff matters. So, you know, if interfaces in like planes and all this kind of stuff were better designed, then maybe more people would be allowed to like be pilots. For example, like you've got that kind of thing happening as well, which is quite unfortunate.
So other than, okay, so let's just, with our little dumb example of a field of red with a green button on it, would you suggest changing the color to fix that? Or what else is there? Could you, you know, is there a stroke that could fix it? Is there iconography that could fix it? Do you recommend stuff like that? Or is it mostly just like, please be aware of this and solve it how you will, but just be aware?
Yeah, I think there's obviously multiple ways of solving problems like that. Beyond actually changing the interface and changing it so that it's on a different color background, you know, you could add an icon, like you mentioned, or make sure the label is clear, maybe give it a stroke to separate it from the background a little. You could add a pattern to it if that is appropriate, just so that it shows that it's different from whatever the background is laying on. Obviously, I would encourage you to think about the interface up front, because if you can design it to be quite obvious in, say, grayscale, then chances are when you put color into it, you're not going to have too much problem.
There's a couple of good tricks there. I like that. I mean, you'd think that would be you tell me, I guess, but kind of like temporarily grayscaling what you look at, mm-hmm. be a way for somebody who isn't colorblind to have a look.
Absolutely.
Kind of work.
I mean, one of the things I've done for quite some time now is whenever I design a website, I will do something like choose the branding colors. If it's a project that I'm responsible for actually choosing the branding colors for, I will choose my branding colors. I will test them up front. I will take a bunch of those colors and say, put them into a little file like Illustrator. You could make it like in CSS, or make a little website, little page. And just take all your color combinations and be like, okay, well, what are the main parts of a website that really have to be legible? And generally, it's going to be things like text, links, buttons, any interface things like that. So if you can take a few samples and actually mock it up and be like, okay, well, I envision, like, because you don't know down the road how you're actually going to use those colors, but you can kind of guess, like you can have like a good estimate. I take those colors, I pair them up, and then I will run a compliance check on it to see what the actual contrast ratio is for those colors. And I can then run it through a color blindness simulator to see if they are still distinguishable. And then if I have any problems with it, I can fix it there before I, you know, present it to the client. And it makes things so much easier, because you kind of know what you're capable of doing with your color palette up front. So when you might get a thing like, you probably won't get a field of red with a green button on it, because you just don't really have that kind of level of experimentation.
There's so many things I'm thinking about. You'd think that patterns thing for a minute was another thing that stood out to me that I think is so interesting. I remember seeing it was just a demo or something. It was somebody who took like a Google pie chart or something and saw how bad it was, you know, looking at it kind of grayscale, you know, like I can't tell these pie chart slices apart, and then applied patterns to it, found some programmatic way to apply, you know, one's polka dot and one's thick stripes and one's thin stripes in another direction or something like that. And the whole thing became completely legible instantly. And the same kind of thing at maps. That's such an interesting way.
Exactly. It really doesn't take that much to take something that's completely inaccessible to somebody with color vision deficiency to being very accessible to not just somebody with color vision deficiency, but somebody who, you know, maybe needs to print a chart out in grayscale because they don't have any color glass. You know, all those things. Like, you have to think, it's not, designing your website to be accessible in that way can benefit so many more people. So I find it very difficult when people push back on it, or they say they don't have time, or they say it's not possible, or, you know, we'll fix it later. It's just, you really need to convince people in your team why it's so important.
I had a programming book that had little illustrations in it. You know, it's kind of a cool little way to humanize programming. And I'm reading it on my Kindle, and I pull up the page with the illustration, and there's just not enough contrast on, so I don't even see it on the Kindle. There's not enough, I think there were times there, like, as you see, I circled in green, you know, or something, and I'm just like, nope, don't see that. I think you draw a good point. Like, if you think about this contrast and you think about how you're using color and how you're communicating with that, and I think you need to do kind of like, sort of like progressive enhancement, I guess. Just sort of like, what happens if this doesn't show up? What happens if you know, blue is not one of the colors we can use or something?
Exactly. I think the progressive enhancement kind of approach to it really does make sense, because you're kind of designing for that lowest common denominator, which is, you know, no color.
So we talked about the color thing. They've briefly mentioned the word contrast, but isn't that another big one? I mean, I guess that's another one that I think there's some awareness of, that colors next to each other or colors on top of each other or whatever need to have some level of contrast for them to work. And that's one of the things that automated testing tools often ding you for, is like, look, you put light gray text on white and it's just not enough, right?
Yeah.
That kind of thing. Is that a big one?
Oh, for sure. Because contrast is the most important part. If you remove color from everything and you are left with a grayscale design, it is going to be that contrast between the elements that makes that's what's going to make your design legible or not. So that is why I really strongly feel that checking your design up front, designing it kind of in grayscale, even if you kind of know what colors you're going to use down the road, chances are, if it works in grayscale and it looks good and everything has enough contrast, and, you know, folks with low vision or people who have trouble reading faded text or anything like that, if they can see it there, when you introduce color to it, chances are it's still going to retain that contrast. So if somebody does have a color vision deficiency, chances are it's probably going to be okay.
Hey folks, do you know that CodePen works pretty well in an education environment? We don't have like CodePen education plans, like one specific plan that you buy if you're a teacher or something for your classroom. It's a little bit more, you'll have to make up your own mind on how you're going to use CodePen and what do you need to make it happen. To some degree, you don't need to buy any paid plan at all, which is funny to say, but you know, all your students can just use free CodePen plans if you want. Maybe you as a teacher should get a pro plan. That way you can like upload assets and even give them the URLs to those assets to use. And you can use things as a teacher like collab mode, so you can be typing at the same time with your students, or probably more realistically, professor mode, which is a pro feature on CodePen that allows you to type and you share that URL out with people who want to watch you, and then they're watching you type as you type and watching everything happen. Like if you open a dialog box to change some settings, they'll see you do that. There's a chat window where you can chat back and forth with the people who are watching you. You're watching the preview update as you type in code. So there's things that are kind of built into CodePen for education, and you can use all of them however you'd like to. You want to, you know, we've seen it set up so that like this, the classroom has like a wiki somewhere else, and the assignments are pens that are ready to go for the students to grab and fork. There might even be embedded pens in there. They're kind of, you know, the pens are built into the lesson plan. we've seen CodePen teams use for education. So the classroom is a team account, and then the owner of the team is the teacher, and the students are put on that team, meaning all those students have pro access, so they have their own bucket of assets and all that stuff. So sometimes that can work. If you have any questions about CodePen and how it works with education, and you know, I'd be happy to talk to you, shoot an email to support@codepen.io, and be happy to talk it through. CodePen is can work for you in education, I almost promise.
Jerry, real quick, I'm a young fancy pants designer. I like opening my clients up to potential lawsuits. This sounds like a lot of work. What's in it for me? I mean, how much work are we talking about here? And what's your thought? Like, I mean, is it, why do people?
My related thought is the incentive thing is that you know, it's important. You can say that, but don't people like follow the carrot usually? Like, is there business incentive here?
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't like really to talk about it because I feel like we kind of have a moral obligation as designers and developers to make our work accessible to other people because that's what we should do. But of course, there are always going to be people maybe higher up in a company who just don't really care and they are really stubborn and are not okay with you changing the colors, or they're not okay with you investing a bit more time in the beginning or throughout the project to actually implement some of these things. So I don't like to talk about it, but yes, of course, you can turn it into a business case because there's so many people affected by it. If you've got 5% of the overall population affected, if you have a major error on your website and, you know, somebody can't complete a task or somebody can't read any of, I don't know, the charts or graphs or anything like that, they're probably not going to stick around. They're just going to click off. They're going to go to a different site. So if you think about how much potential lost readership and sales that you could have from a problem like that, I feel like in theory, that should be enough to convince somebody higher up if they really don't care about ethics, which I would hope that they did.
Yeah, 5%. I mean, that's 1 in 20. You know, I mean, you're sitting around with 20 friends. It's like, One of them is probably has a color deficiency. So,
yeah. Workflow wise, that idea of designing in grayscale is pretty interesting. That would be, you know, because that's what we're talking about here, right? Is we can talk about all these, like what the problem is, but the workflow is another whole aspect of it. It's not just awareness of what the problems are, but fixing it from a workflow perspective. So there's that. It also occurred to me that, you know, fixing these problems one-off is good but limited, right? It seems like fixing one button isn't the way to go. It's fixing all your buttons.
Yeah. It if you've got a serious problem that goes beyond just tweaking the color of some links or, you know, if you have a massive, massive website, some of these things might not be such a big deal if you've just got like a 5-page site. But if you have a huge corporate site, then you could be talking about a lot of work to do at the end of the project that might never get done because the site is launched and, you know, you've got other things to do. So you really just need to teach the people on your team why it's important. And, you know, as a last kind of resort, talk about lawsuits. You know, if somebody isn't convinced or if a client isn't convinced and they're just really stubborn and they want it to look this way, you need to bring up these examples of, you know, companies who have been sued because their site's been inaccessible. So it's not nice. It's because I really wish that people would do it because they care about the users, they care about the readers, but unfortunately, as we all know, that doesn't always happen. So sometimes, you know, bring out the big guns and try to convince people that way.
You have an example. I thought this was really cool. An example in your book about like labeling colors of products, you know, because if it's, you know, just a visual, Like, here's this product. You don't act, if you're, you know, have a color deficiency, you don't see that, you know, you are not, you don't see the naviness or the, I don't, I guess the red or the green, you know, so it might be helpful to label. And I'm actually, it reminds me, I had a roommate in college who was red, green colorblind, and he would come to me in the morning, like before he's going to work, and he's like, "Hey, does this outfit look all right?" And I was just like, "What do you mean?" And he's like, "I just can't see. I don't know what color the shirt is, and like if these pants, if they match, you know, or if they like
what,
you know, like." And so, like, he'd just be like, "I mean, I'm guessing here, but," and I was like, "Yeah, you're fine." But it was just, you know, that's a problem I don't have, you know. But it was interesting that my roommate would have to like come in and talk to me and just be like, "Hey, dude, does this work? You don't think about that."
No, but it is quite common. And, you know, you take that same situation where he would come to you and ask you if this looks okay, and then take that situation, put it on the internet if you are going to be buying some clothing. Mm-hmm. You know, if that color name is ridiculous or it's not described properly, that person will then probably have to go to somebody like you or somebody else and say, "Hey, can you tell me what the color of this is?" And, you know, not taking into consideration color management and all that stuff of different monitors, because of course there's going to be variations, but I mean more extreme examples, like, you know, maybe somebody doesn't really want a pink shirt, but they end up buying one because it wasn't described properly. So yeah, it is something you really have to be very mindful of.
It's an example where you might actually describe the color instead of not describing the color. Like, if you were saying, "Don't click the green button, don't put that in your copy." But if you're selling a green shirt, it should probably say, "This is a green shirt."
Exactly. And one of my favorite examples as well is, you know, when you are describing the color of, say, clothing, or I don't know, could be anything, it doesn't have to be clothing, but clothing is probably the most common thing you're going to purchase online that will give you problems. Don't use these really ridiculous names that you find like on cans of paint, like in very fancy
flower.
Yeah. So, like, my favorite, I have an example here. This is my favorite. So this is from the Superdry website. I'm not sure if they still have it, but they used to have it. And there was a green sweater and a brown sweater and a gray sweater. And the green sweater had a blue logo. The brown sweater had a green logo, and the gray sweater had a red logo. And the color combinations, they are called, the green one was called Woodland and Sky. And yeah, and the brown one was called Iced Coffee and Apple. Mm-hmm. And the gray one was called Ashes and Coral. So I feel like, what does that mean? It doesn't mean anything. Grape is also a really bad word, because like what is grape? Like grapes are purple, but grapes are also green, so which one is it? And I know that like a lot of people with color vision deficiencies can kind of make assumptions based on this, but at the same time, there's still no reason for your copywriters to go completely off the wall and be completely ridiculous. I really feel like if you're going to have a green jumper or a green sweater or whatever it is, just call it green. Like, whatever the names that you would describe in a rainbow, like, try to be as close to that as possible. So, you know, if it's light green, call it light green. If it's dark green, call it dark green. If you just use those kinds of names, it would make things a lot easier. And you have to think about people who might not speak English as a first language. You know, they will probably understand what green is, but they're probably not going to understand what woodland means. So mm-hmm. It's just, there's just so many things that you need to consider, and the simpler it is, I just think the safer you're going to be.
I like the tooling that calls out this the contrast problems, because it's so like every site in the world, I feel like, screws this one up. Like, you did it. You did the light gray. It's too light. You did it. So, but I wonder if where that comes from is that, because it's not like designers are like, I made this light gray just because I love light gray as a color. Designers think about like hierarchy and things like that. Like, they make it light gray so that it's less emphasized because they're trying to make something else stand out that's more predominant on purpose.
Yeah.
So like light gray kind of like, is this like when you have to rein that in, when you get called out for that, with a designer, I could see firing back and be like, I made it that way on purpose. I really picked that gray because of the, I'm trying to establish this hierarchy there. If you're forcing me to rein this in, that I'm losing some of that hierarchy that I was trying to establish. How would you respond to like a reaction?
Well, I have a few opinions on this. And one of my opinions is that there are quite a few web designers who come from other industries, and they may not necessarily come from a design background. So there are quite a few web designers out there who may just kind of go with what the trends are. And I think that can kind of snowball. And there's also some things I've heard a while ago saying things like, you should never use 100% black for your text because it's too harsh and it's going to create eye strain and that sort of thing.
That's a super popular one.
Yeah. So, I mean, that can be true to an extent, but I feel like some people might get a little carried away with it. And to kind of make things worse,
how that could be a little damaging. Like, just don't get carried away with contrast here, designers.
Yeah. Going
low contrast.
Like low contrast. I feel like lower contrast design over the past few years, like since we started to get into a little bit more artistic and a little bit more, you know, not what a website should look like, not like this is what a website looks like in 1997 and all links are blue and underlined and all text is either Times New Roman or Comic Sans. I think people have started to kind of use it more as, you know, an advertising medium as well. And with that, you bring a bit of thing like a bit of a thought of luxury. And often, you know, pure black text on a white background does not really look that luxurious. You tone it back a bit and it just gives this level of it looks a little bit more slick. And I think people have latched onto that too much. They've made it too soft. They've made it way too difficult to see. And now you can't let go of it because you see it on websites like, you know, Dribbble and whatever. Like, there's a lot of great looking, kind of stylish, luxurious looking things, but in reality, it's not accessible. And I think that kind of trend, it's still there. I still see it every day. I think people...
almost like a fun Tumblr or something, like really, really hot, accessible designs, you know? So it's not just like... So I feel like if you looked up design gallery and then like, show me A11Y designs, like you'd probably see stuff that's like, I don't know. Maybe that's just me, but it seems like accessible design doesn't usually feel like hand in hand with like really trendy.
Yeah, well, I mean that is one of the stigmas I think around accessibility. People think, a lot of designers especially will think that accessibility or 100%, which, you know, is quite difficult to achieve, but very accessible websites cannot possibly look good. And that's something that people, like, we've had to deal with for a long time. That is not true. And that's why I say, if you think about it up front and you don't do it as an afterthought, if you are able to sit down and think about your color choices and how you're going to use them, can you make compliant pairs of text and background colors up front? If you can do that, there's no reason why you can't make your site look absolutely gorgeous and be as accessible as possible. So I think it's just people who have the wrong kind of understanding of what accessibility is and what it has to be, and thinking about it as an afterthought, and we're just not going to worry about it because it has to look good. Like, looking good is number one, and that it happens just way too much.
I'm being the worst person. Is this okay? I went to Dribbble, and I'm just going through the popular thing and running it through a color contrast analyzer, and they're all failing. I'm the worst. I'm the worst human.
I do stuff like that, too. I do. I'm terrible.
But I think it's less terrible than, like, an alternative to that is, like, go to popular websites and run them through, like, an HTML valid checker and see them fail or whatever, and then be little bitchy about that. It's like that, it doesn't matter so much, because just because it's invalid doesn't mean that it actually affects anything in any way. But running actual design through a contrast checker does mean it affects actual humans in a way. You know, the proof is right there.
Yeah. I'm a bit guilty of it. At the same time, I'm also quite guilty of being on the receiving end when my most recent book came out and somebody said that the color contrast of the cover design was not compliant.
Oops.
which I was aware of, but anyway.
Yeah, it's tough. It's tough. So I guess how do you balance, or how do you keep it top of mind? That's maybe my thing, is like,
for workflow, you know, right?
Just, you have to kind of build it in and check regularly.
Yeah, you just keep it top of mind, you know, actually have an interest in it, learn about why it matters, learn about the people who have problems with it, learn about what can happen if it isn't accessible. And the more you understand about it, like you said about muscle memory, you know, chances are you're going to remember it every time you design something.
I mean, the more times we say muscle memory, the better, I think. And it's like that with anything. It's like that with, I mean, certainly this accessibility stuff is in there, but it's like, what type of CSS layout do you reach for? Do you reach for an image optimization tool for every image that you put on the web? Do you think about properly putting state where it needs to be in a site before you mess with it? It's like all these things require a little muscle memory that you develop and change and morph over a lifetime.
Exactly. And if you take your eye off the ball, it just gets more difficult, which is why web design these days is so difficult. And I would not want to be somebody starting out in this industry.
It's sad to think that in a way. And then sometimes I see, I don't know, new kids starting out, or, you know, they don't have to be kids, it could be anybody, but kids metaphorically in the newbie sense of the web, who don't seem to be struggling that badly, that it like seems complicated to us old timers, but maybe their fresh minds and attitudes or whatever are like, you're doing fine.
I also think that they have a bit of a leg up, because anything that's important on the web that you need to know today is well documented, and it's not like when we started out, when a lot of these things we kind of had to just guess, or we didn't really have anybody. I know myself personally, when I made my first website in, I think it was 1998 or something like that, I didn't have anybody to teach me how to make it. So I struggled for a really long time. I didn't understand HTML. I didn't understand what an HTML editor was. But today, even though things are so much more complicated, there's so many better resources out there. Somebody can just sit down and be like, okay, this is what I should understand, this is what I should learn how to do. And also there's more mentors out there as well. Like, if you have a question, you've got access to Twitter. If you've got nice people who are willing to help you, you've got that. There was none of that before, so I think that's why, you know, combined with younger people's drive to want to learn this thing and their better access of resources, I think that, you know, I joke about it being really difficult, but I feel like it's probably not that bad.
The thing that occurs to me is about all things web is that sometimes browsers themselves step in to save us. And it's, you know, I'm sure there's a million examples that we could come up with, actually, because they do sometimes. And I wonder if the technology will change such to help in kind of big, important ways. You know, I mean, I can imagine that things like contrast are technologically solvable problems, at least to some degree. I even know at the OS level that you can flip on some like high contrast mode kind of things. I think Windows has some version of high contrast mode. Is that like a, do you know, I wonder if that's a, I don't know, a get out of jail free card for designers in some way or not?
I would say no, because it's still important to kind of understand why people experience these problems. And you can't guarantee that everybody is going to have the same technology or access to technology. And also, there are some issues with things like that, like the Windows high contrast mode. It doesn't work on everything. Now, I'm not sure if it will in the future, but if you have any kind of icons, SVG icons, that are really essential, or any kind of graphics that are done in SVG, and you need to be able to tell what that icon is, like maybe a check mark or an X or anything like that, Windows high contrast mode does not necessarily work on those kinds of images. Now, there is a method now that you can use to target Windows high contrast mode specifically with CSS media queries, which I think is super cool. So yeah, I think, you know, there, the technology probably will change over time, but I don't think that really should be a get out of jail for free card.
High contrast mode is like an extreme.
It is very extreme for sure.
It's like a almost like for blindness, and it's often used in conjunction with a zoom, like a major user zoom situation. I do wonder if there's like a, I don't know, like an ensure contrast button just that just kind of loops through all your colors and just like audits them and min maxes the values or something. I think that would be interesting. But
with style sheets and you know, you could do that from the browser yourself if you've got a style like a user style sheet that you can apply to pretty much any site. So yes, that you can definitely do that, but at the same time, there's going to be a lot of people who don't know how to do that or don't understand that kind of technology. So if you understand it and you can implement it, that's great. And of course, you know, you could build a plugin for the browser, and I wouldn't be surprised if something like that exists. But you know, it's not just websites, it's apps, and it's anything digital, anything on a digital screen. It could be an interface on a plane. You know, what would you do in that case? It's not all about websites. I think any kind of digital screen or output device is something that you really need to think about.
I hang out with my 8-year-old neighbor, Cleo. She's great. But I've seen her like pull up a site on her phone. She uses an iPhone. She's like very on trend, but she just, the contrast wasn't there, you know? And she just was like, I'm done. Like, I mean, she's 80. That's like, she was trying to hire a plumber and she just couldn't read the website. So she's like, I'm done. Like that was too much. Like, and she's, you know, got a modern device. She can zoom in, you know, but she just was like, that's too hard to read. So like, and that's nothing to be like, you know, she's just 80, you know, or, you know, my mom who's 60 has the same problem. Just kind of like, well, I'm not going to read that because it's too hard.
Exactly. And it's really sad because those same kinds of people can think, you know, they can feel like there's something wrong with them when in reality, it's not their fault. It's just something that they can't do or complete because of bad design.
That's what data wise it looks boring, but that shows up in data as low time on site and low conversions and bounce rate and things. That's funny to think of those like numbers where you're just like, oh, you know, you just look at those numbers and forget sometimes perhaps that they're they could be Dave's neighbor.
Yeah, I mean, I think I do get bummed out that it's like, ugh, all these rules, all these ratios and rules and, you know, but, you know, I kind of think at some point, I think I accepted, like, this is web design. Like, it just has to do this. And it's maybe not going to look the coolest, most trendiest. And, you know, somebody's going to make a neon site and it's going to look so cool and I'm going to be so jealous. But, like, it's not web design. Like, web design is, it's what works for everybody. And I think, you know, I think that was like a bitter pill or, you know, to swallow that everything's not going to be all super cool all the time because you do have to kind of adjust to, like, meet these requirements. But, you know, I think design isn't, you guys are more designer than I am, but design is about, like, the limitations that can be the thing that births the design. Like, what are the limitations? Cool. I'm going to, like, make the best thing in that, in the limitation set.
So. Yeah. I mean, personally, as a designer, I enjoy having those kinds of restrictions because I like to just be presented with that kind of a problem and then actually figure out how to solve it. And I just think that people need to change their attitude about it. And if they understand why it's so important and how you need to treat it like a problem solving sort of thing, think about, okay, these are going to be the restrictions, and then figure out how can I still make this look super cool, super slick, and be super accessible. I mean, if I can achieve that, it's just going to make me feel even more proud about the output. And I think if you treat it that way and treat it as a problem to solve and try to be proud of what you make and be proud of how accessible your site is, even if it's not 100%, you know, you still need to try. And then the next time on the next project, you can try to make it even more accessible. And eventually, you're just going to be, hopefully, it's kind incredible. Of cool.
like nice sentence, nice sentiment to treat it like a challenge. Like we're all trying to get better at our craft in a way.
Yeah, yeah.
We're trying to get more clever with our code and more, you know, design more extensible libraries and whatever. Like, why not think of this?
Yeah, I think people think of it in a negative way too much. Like, oh, I have to make this accessible, and that is just. Right from the beginning, you're in the mindset that this is going to be a chore.
It's just sucks that you can't. I mean, whatever. I'm not trying to defend any of that behavior, but it's hard to gamify or whatever. Like, I can't. If I do a great job, I don't all of a sudden get 98 out of 100 instead of a 72 out of 100 because the tools just aren't really built that way. And I don't work in JAWS every day, so actually, like, if I do a great job in my code, like. I don't really know. I don't have immediate feedback if I've done things successful. So I wonder if those things could get better. Like, if we could incentivize developers to I don't know, if it could be a little more gamified or something, I think this would get a lot better.
It's like, you know, the saying, like, good design is invisible. It's like, well, good accessibility should also probably be invisible in that. And if it's there and it works, you don't encounter any problems with it, then yes, I can understand why, you know, you might not get much gratification out of it because it works, but, you know, you have to think about, again, like, do you want people shouting at you because your site isn't accessible? And
that's the way you need to gamify it. Less support tickets.
Yeah. Yeah. Less lawsuits.
Yeah, that's a good, I think that's good to end. Just, yeah, that's great. Well, thank you, Jerry, so much for coming on the show, talking about this. For people who aren't following you and giving you money, how can they do that?
They can follow me at HelloJerry on Twitter and follow my website, HelloJerry.com. And you can buy my book at abookapart.com. And it's cheap.
Yeah. It's one of the like, it's the quick read ones. They're good. They're good. All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. I mean, I think I learned a lot, and I'm also like, I do have things I need to fix on my site. So I'm going to do that. So thank you very much for inspiring me to do that. And thank you, dear listener, for downloading this in your podcatcher choice. Be sure to star, heart, favorite it up. That's how people find out about the show. Follow us on Twitter at Shop Talk Show for tens of tweets a month. And if you hate your job, head over to shoptalkshow.com/jobs and get a brand new one, because people want to hire people like you. And Chris, do you have anything else you'd like to 999 on FFF? Just kidding. That's a joke. All right.
Oh, shoptalkshow.com.